I got to get out of here. John Carley and Sherry Alliker coming up next. God bless you in these crazy times, and I'll see you back here tomorrow for a Friday extravaganza.
All right, welcome to the John Carley, Sherry Alliker radio experience, soon with haptic feedback and smell-o-vision. From what I'm told, Sherry, you guys are going to have full suits that you can zip up and then feel as if you're in the room with John Carley and his testosterone and his Tom Ford cologne, and then you with your huge hands, right? That's what I hear tell is going to happen.
Wait, so he gets testosterone and a Tom Ford cologne? I just, all that I'm known for are these big hands.
And the hands emit a smell?
Yeah.
Let's don't make it any worse, please.
Brian Buckaloo, our program director, and I were talking about John Curley's steroid use, and I was comparing my steroid use to John Curley's steroid use, and I have a sneaking suspicion that John is in a completely different amalgam. I don't think he's just taking vitamins and testosterone. I think he's on something else. That guy is in amazing shape. Have you seen John Curley recently in person? Jacob, have you?
He hasn't been in the studio in a while, so right. I can't. Is he even bulkier, I guess?
Well, I haven't seen him since I saw him a couple months ago, but he's in amazing shape for a guy who's 82 years old, right?
When he gets out of that wheelchair, boy, he is buff.
He can do some squats.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so everybody hates it when I talk about drugs, so we decided to open the show talking about drugs. There is a...
Because Give the people what they want.
I know. There's been a major settlement that was reached by the state of Washington and some of these opioid producers. Here's Cairo News Radio's own Hannah Scott reporting on the payout the state of Washington will receive from the pharmaceutical companies in the wake of the opioid epidemic.
The $518 million payout, the result of a resolution in principle with McKesson, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen, according to State Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who sued the three distributors more than 2 years ago.
These three companies knew or should have known they were shipping suspicious orders into our state.
Most other states opting to accept an earlier settlement offer from the companies, but the AG didn't believe it was an adequate offer, leading to this larger payout, about $46 million more than the AG would have got for the state, had he settled. Most important,
the overwhelming majority of this amount, $476 million, must be used to address the opioid epidemic.
Hannah Scott, Cairo News Radio.
Sherry, people hate my opinion on this issue. They despise it. They detest it. This is like my hottest of hot takes. People hate it when I talk about my thoughts and feelings on this particular issue. And I'm not totally sure why. Because I'm totally correct about it. I am 100% correct on this. And then the other weird thing before we get to my hot take is then people attack my drug addict bona fides, and they say that I'm like a fake drug addict, or that I was a fake drug addict. Like that's something that I would brag about. Do you know what I mean? Like that, it's kind of a weird personal attack that people do against me whenever I give my hot take on who should be accountable when it comes to the quote unquote opioid epidemic.
It's complicated. And are they suggesting somehow you're embellishing your resume? Is that part of the problem?
Okay. Like they probably think that I took some Tylenol 3s for like 3 weeks and then I was like, I'm an addict, and that I wasn't freebasing.
I'm detoxing.
Help me, please. So my hot take on this is that I'm fine with states suing these companies. I have no issue with it whatsoever. But I do think that we're pointing the finger at the wrong people. I hear a lot of politicians saying these evil drug corporations took advantage of so forth and so on. My thought is, as someone who was a drug addict between, 2006 to about 2017, that was all me. That was all my motivation. That was all me trying to get drugs, trying to get pills, trying to get opiates. No big pharma rep ever came up to me and said, hey, Sonny Jim, you want some more opiates? I had to do it all myself. So when I hear this, like, we need to go after these pharmaceutical companies for distributing a product that all these people wanted, I don't really get it. I mean, I understand that they violated the law in quotation marks when it came to distributing pills. Sherry, do you have the numbers on, like, I think in some places it was like enough pills to kill everybody in the state at some point in time. Like, it was just a gargantuan amount of drugs, right?
Right. I don't have those exact numbers, but yes, it was unbelievable. And there were a couple of pharmacies, say in West Virginia,
right,
that were such pill mills that they were, you know, it was as if every single person in that particular town had like 20 prescriptions,
yeah,
or something like that.
Yeah.
So it was extraordinary. I do want to ask you this, Jack. In your travels, when you were addicted, mm-hmm, to whatever, did you ever meet anybody that had the story of what we've heard having with these drug companies? For instance, that they had an injury, that they started with these drugs, they got hooked on these drugs, they no longer were able to get them legitimately, so they went out on the street to then get heroin or some other kind of opioid to help them with their pain or whatever. Did you ever meet anybody that started their whole drug addiction with a prescription?
No. I mean, rarely. Like, most of the time people were like casual alcoholics, or maybe they smoked a lot of marijuana, or, but the people that I was hanging out with, we were like psychonauts, right? We wanted to expand our minds using heroin and cocaine and those kinds of things. There was not this, like, I was a contractor and a father of four, and then I broke my foot on a ladder, and then I started taking Vicodin, and I became so addicted to the Vicodin that when my doctor cut me off, I started freebasing heroin. Not really. I feel like that's a narrative that people create. The majority of the drug addicts that I interacted with were kind of, it was already innate in them. They were already kind of addicts to begin with, and then they kind of stumbled onto their drug of choice. Kind of like, Sherry, you know, like how if you're a drinker, you tend to have your drink, like you're like I'm a Chivas Regal type of guy, or I'm a Barnum and Bailey's kind of gal. You know,
okay,
what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
Like,
sure.
For instance, like, Jacob is like a Sunny Delight kind of guy. He loves himself some Sunny Delight, right,
yeah,
Jacob?
I can see that.
Yeah.
Right. Like, Andrew is like a Monster Energy drink kind of guy. That's just what he does.
Oh, yeah.
when I was a drug addict, I was just a heroin and cocaine kind of a guy. The pills were just kind of a convenience to stave off having to go into horrible withdrawals. But getting back to my original point, like, we say all the time we need to hold drug addicts accountable. I don't blame the opioid epidemic on companies that were making a product and then doctors who were doling out that product. I blame it on the consumer. What you're basically asking me to do, if you want me to follow this line of logic, is you're basically saying obesity is the number one cause of preventable death in the United States, leading to heart disease, cancer, diabetes, so on and so forth. We need to sue Coca-Cola for making a great product that everybody enjoys. It's basically the same thing, but we don't do that. Right. Even though we all know that Coca-Cola is basically poison, it's probably the worst thing that you could put into your body. But we all shrug our shoulders because it's legal. But then when we get to prescription pills, all of a sudden it's, ooh, these evil pharmaceutical companies knew that this was addictive. Well, we know that sugar is addictive. I mean, it's a silly argument, and I don't think that we should do it anymore. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I can see where the argument for personal responsibility comes in here, and I agree with you on that. But I do think that there is culpability with these companies because we don't really know enough. We know a lot about addiction, but we don't know that much about it and how
right.
the brain works with each individual person. So I do believe that the way that they misled doctors and the way that they misled people into believing that these drugs were 100% safe, non-addictive,
okay.
all of that led to far more people becoming addicted because we don't really know. You know, I could take 15 pills and put them in the cupboard and never care about them again. You could take three and crave them for the rest of your life. So we don't know in terms of people's chemistry who's going to become addicted or not. And so I think that that in that way, so many more people did become addicted to the particular, these particular prescription drugs, and then, yes, went out on the street and got other drugs. Is it solely their responsibility? Absolutely not, because everybody knows that if you have a problem, and if we're going to make it a medical problem, and that's the philosophy now, is that it is absolutely a medical problem. It's not a moral failing. It's something that you can deal with. Then it is your responsibility to get help for it, and to be able to lead a productive life in spite of it, or to, you know, to be able to recover from it if you can. So, I mean, I think sometimes it takes these kinds of lawsuits to send a message to companies in a bigger way, no matter what it is, about misleading the public, about misleading, doctors or patients or anything, that this maybe, just maybe, it will do something for ethics in the world.
Yeah, I can. I
possibly.
Can, right. I can see that argument. Part of my concern is that, I, being a drug addict, a former drug addict, I did a lot of research into this because I, too, at one point in time was like, these evil pharmaceutical companies making this thing that I love to take every single day. If you look into kind of the history of it, physicians have known that opiates are addictive. They've known this for thousands of years, ever since they were started to cultivate the opium out of poppy seeds. And then in post-Civil War United States, they had the Harrison Tax Act, because they saw all these guys out there who were Civil War vets who were smoking a lot of opium or using morphine or whatever it was, and they were effectively like buying it off of, like you could just walk down to the pharmacy in the same way that you and I go down to a CVS, and you could say, I will have my opium, and I will have my heroin, and I will have my cocaine, thank you very much. And then they passed the Harrison Tax Act, so you couldn't do that anymore. So we've known that addiction has been a thing for nigh on thousands of years. I don't blame the doctors for having patients who are effectively customers coming to them and saying, my ankle hurts, my back hurts. And then that doctor goes, okay, here's some Vicodin. And then they say, that doesn't work anymore. And they go, okay, well, here's some Percocets. I don't blame those physicians for being bad at their jobs. I blame the consumer in the same way that I blame the person who, like, do you remember the girl who sued Subway? Or the woman who sued McDonald's because she claimed that the food made her fat. Do you remember this?
I vaguely remember that, yes.
Right. There was the young lady who sued Subway because she said that Jared in particular had misled her to believing that she could lose weight eating Subway 7 days out of the week. Mm-hmm. We all know that that is a lie. I feel like that is the kind of narrative that people want me to buy into in order to blame pharmaceutical companies. They knew that the drugs were addictive. They knew that people wanted them. And lo and behold, tens of millions of Americans wanted them, and they wanted to take them every single day. Should they be held responsible to an extent? Yes, I agree with that. But I'm also saying that we need to, like, look at the actual drug addict themselves. And I just want to remind people, one of a drug addict's favorite things to do is to blame other people for their problems. We love to do it. We do it all the time. It's your fault that I'm addicted to drugs. It's your fault that I keep doing this. It's not my fault that I'm an addict. When in fact, the opposite is true. And in the millions of Americans, if not the tens of millions of Americans who engaged in drug-seeking behavior, that's on them as far as I'm concerned, because that it's on me, right? And maybe I'm being a little bit too, like, self-referential here because I made the decision to get off of drugs. But that's just the way that I view it. I view it in very capitalist terms. There was a product. People wanted it. Doctors gave it out. There you go. So...
Well, and we just got this text message. It says, and I did it backwards. I drank and did drugs, got clean, then rode horses and had lots of injuries. And now I'm in pain and they want to take away my meds.
Exactly.
You know what will happen? We will all be on the street trying to get something to help our pain. They're trying to take away cancer patients' pain meds. And that is one of the, I don't know, intended, unintended consequences of all
right.
of this, is that now that people that really need pain medication for legitimate pain have an impossible time getting it. When my husband was in a terrible accident and he was in excruciating pain. I took him back to the emergency room because he was absolutely couldn't even function. He was in so much pain. They gave him Benadryl. They just wouldn't. I mean, and it was awful. And I had to beg them to help him. So I mean. You know, and I said, I was in a panic and I said, look, you know, if he gets addicted, I'll deal with it. You know, just do something, please. I'll take him there myself. I don't care. I mean, I was just so frantic about what to do to help him.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They were just like, we're not going to go there. We can manage this differently. We're not going to, you know, so
right.
It's a very complicated subject on so many different levels. I'm just glad if they can get some money to, because what we need most in this country is availability for, you know, beds and treatment. And if this money can go to that, and they say a large portion of it will, I mean, 400, I think, out of the 518 million, 476 million will go directly to, you know, addiction and treatment and all of that. So maybe it'll help.
Great news. And I really hope that it does help. And I really hope that the money goes to good places. And I will say, I do feel bad for patients who suffer from chronic pain. And I feel almost personally responsible for being that guy back in 2012 in the emergency room being like, my back hurts. And they're like, here's some Percocets, now leave. Because I contributed to that. Do you know what I mean? So it is a it's interesting to see how the world changes. Hey, speaking of, by the way, Chris Martin, one of my new favorite guitar players of all time. Sherry, have you heard Chris Martin play guitar?
I have only heard you brag about Chris Martin playing guitar, so I got to put that on my bucket list.
The man, the band Kinski is like four virtuosos composing all simultaneously, and it is amazing. And now we have Chris Martin, literally the heart and soul of Cairo Radio, doing traffic for us. How you doing, Chris Martin?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well, buddy.
Thanks for that intro. I don't know how to live up to that.
Oh, you're welcome. Keel Mortgage, proud sponsors of the John Curley, Sherry Elicker Experience, radio program experience, soon with haptic feedback. 1-888-778-KIEL. 5-star reviews, Sherry Elicker, everywhere you go on the internet. I just Googled them really quick. I thought, let me check these guys out. 5-star reviews. 1-888-778-KIEL. Sherry, you ever take out a mortgage? I haven't I haven't done that yet in my life. I have no idea that works. I don't know what it is.
Well, the people at Keel Mortgage will talk you through every bit of it, and they'll hold your hand every step of the way. They'll make sure that you get what you need, and you get a really solid understanding of what you're signing.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Sherry. So this is a tricky topic, I think, Sherry. So I'm going to take a step back a little bit on this, but the long and the short of it is that there's a new trend on TikTok, everybody's favorite new social media platform, and basically what people do is they film their maybe their parent or their grandparent who is suffering with dementia, and then they put that on TikTok, and this is generally like 90 seconds to about 2 minutes worth of footage. And, Jacob, we have some audio cuts, but I kind of want to just skip over it because I don't really want to give these horrible people any credit in any kind of light of day. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no. I had the same feeling. I watched through a lot of these examples, and it makes you feel kind of gross, honestly. You know, I'm really conflicted about it. There's something that I think could be valuable for certain people, or maybe if you're going through it and you see someone else dealing with it, that makes you, I don't know, feel like you're not alone. But at the same time, I don't think that's all of the motivation for most of the people posting these. So it is kind of, I agree, kind of gross.
So Sherry, your dad is living with dementia currently. And when we were talking about this in the pre-show meeting, you had some hot and spicy takes about this as someone who actually lives in this world. Would you want to share those with us?
Yeah, so I've never talked about this on the air because my dad's, you know, very private, and so am I to some degree. But I think that this really made an impression on me because when I read about this in the Wall Street Journal about that this particular group of videos have gotten over 2.8 billion views, and that part didn't really surprise me because so many families are dealing with dementia, and so many families, you know, have to endure. They may be the number one caregiver. They may not have, you know, a lot of help, and they look for support. So I watched these videos with curiosity to try to see if I thought they would be something inspirational or educational for me, having a dad that's in the early stages of dementia. And I didn't come to that conclusion at all. I found them to be kind of disturbing, and I think that they exploited some of the people on there. It is a really awful, awful disease. My dad's one of the lucky ones. He's in a tremendous facility. He gets great care. He's got, you know, kids that adore him and help him. He's been married to my mom for 67 years. So he's got the best of all conditions when it comes to having something like this. But it's so painful. You know, my dad worked for NSA for 45 years. He went to Harvard. He went to the National War College. He's a brilliant, brilliant guy. And to watch the decline, it comes on sometimes so suddenly that you're just, you can't even really trace when it started. All of a sudden, you know, they just aren't the same, and they don't remember anything, or they have like compulsive activities or things that they do over and over and over again. You can't explain it. Luckily, he still knows who we are, and he's not in an advanced stage, but it's definitely there. And when I saw some of these videos of the behavior that they were documenting, I just thought, I don't buy the fact that they are aware that this is being done to them. And I choose those words on purpose because that's what it feels like to me. It feels like they're being victimized. It feels like they are doing it for just to get views, or so somebody can be a little bit more famous on TikTok. And I agree with Jacob. It's gross. I would never do that. I just don't think that it's the right thing to do. And I don't know how you really get a whole lot of comfort or support in a 90-second video of somebody not remembering how to sing.
Right.
I'm sorry. That's just pain. That's just, you know, pain and sadness in action. And I don't want to ever see them again.
Right. I think it's a boundaries thing, Sherry. I think I just figured it out. Because you just outlined kind of the overarching theme of what you were saying is, I have all these great boundaries with my dad and with my siblings and with my mom and with this facility. And it's like really healthy boundaries. And these Zoomers, apparently, and some of these millennials, unfortunately, have really bad boundaries. I guess it's almost like if I were to film arguments that I have with Sarah and then put those on the internet and ask people to comment on them, right? Or like when Sarah's father passed away, if I were to have filmed that in the hospital and then put it on the internet, it's really gross. And yet so many people out there just have bad boundaries, like bad interpersonal boundaries, and they go, oh yeah, no, I'll get all kinds of support for putting this on the internet.
Well, and I think that there's a whole group of people, there's a subculture of people that do get something out of it.
Yeah.
It's not me, it may not be you, but I think that because people are so obsessed with TikTok and that's where they get their news, that's where they think their friends are, it's that connection that they have that I can't relate to at all. But it may work for them. But I just don't think documenting someone's illness or decline or anything and putting it out there in, you know, 45 seconds or 90 second little clips of anything accomplishes much. I really don't. If you want to document something before your loved one gets to the point where their memory is completely gone or they're incapacitated, then do that for the family, right? I mean, do that as a way to preserve some of what they have left. But to put it on TikTok, I mean, at the very least, it's tacky.
Very tacky, and like even just looking at the thumbnails that are part of the TikTok videos, I was like, oh wow, this is gross. Like, I feel like I'm invading somebody else's world in so many ways, even though they're offering it up. Sherry, I got to tell you the story about when somebody asked me to make a documentary about a man who was being released from prison and why I turned down tens of thousands of dollars in order to not make this documentary. I got to tell you this story.
Oh, I want to hear that.
That's a great story. So maybe we'll talk about Dave Chappelle, or maybe we'll talk about the time that I turned down thousands of dollars right. in order to not do a documentary. So.
Wait, I just got to know before you tell the story. Yeah. Regret it or happy about your decision?
So happy. So the happiest I've ever been is not taking that video assignment. All right. So, Sherry, when I was 28 years old, I was a burgeoning young director in the world of film. And I was referred to a woman who wanted to make a documentary about a man who was being released from prison. Now, this woman had money to burn. She was a social worker by choice. She was came from a lot of money, and she was also just happened to be a social worker and a paralegal. And I met with this woman over dinner, and she was very, very excited to make a documentary about a man who was one of her clients. He had been imprisoned in the state of California when he was 18 years old. When he was 17 years old, this is back in the 70s, he and his buddies kidnapped a young lady, held her for ransom, did awful things to her, and then threatened to murder her before dumping her in the Tenderloin District in San Francisco, California. They were caught, and he was given life in prison when he turned 18. And California that year had passed a law in which for those prisoners, for those people who were inmates, they were going to review their sentencing. So if you had committed a crime when you were 17 and then you were sentenced when you were 18, they were going to review this. So there was a possibility that this guy was going to get out. And he had been in prison for the better part of like 35, 40 years. He had never seen snow. He hadn't had a cheeseburger in that number of years. It was all this stuff. So I meet with this woman, and she's kind of a portly woman. She is very kind of overly excitable, very giddy, asking me lots of technical questions that she didn't need to know about. And she says, I want to film him leaving the prison, and I want to film me taking him to the mountains to see snow and seeing his siblings who he hasn't seen in 30 or 40 years. And I'm thinking, like, okay, like, cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. I'm just literally just, like, cash registers are going off in my brain as to how expensive this is going to be. And I want drone shots of him standing in Yosemite, and I'm just thinking, money, 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 money. And then the conversation takes a really weird turn. She gets really, really quiet. She goes, can I tell you something else? I go, yeah. She says, I love this man. This man and I have developed a relationship. Thomas and I have decided that we're going to get married when he is released. Over the last 10 years, we have discovered that we have the same love language. He likes gifts and I like gifts. We like the same colors. We like the same things. And I want you to film me marrying this man. And we'll feature it at the end of the documentary. And then we'll release it. And I know that you're going to win tons of awards for this. And I went, I'm going to have to think about this. So basically what she wanted me to do is she wanted me to, like, film her romance with this guy. And so when I was going back over it in my mind, she wanted me to film them meeting when he was released from prison, them going to the snow together, them eating cheeseburgers together. She wanted me to film their relationship effectively and then cut it into a quote-unquote documentary. And she was going to pay me tens of thousands of dollars to do this. And I turned it down. I said, absolutely not. I will not exploit that man for other people's entertainment and for your own enjoyment. It just seemed to be so perverse to me, this idea that this man, who basically had the coping skills of a child, he had been in prison since he was 18 years old, it just felt so exploitative to me that I just said, I can't morally do that to the man, because there are circumstances which I am sure that both he and you want to have privacy. So for, as an example, you know, the first time he, you know, I don't know, touches grass when he gets out of prison, I don't want to film a full grown man crying like a small child it just felt too invasive and too much, so I turned it down, Sherry. That's that story.
Yeah, I don't blame you. And not only that, but it's like, what is she doing? Like,
yes, if you want to do,
you know, if you want to make a love letter to him, then do something different. Like the two of you, wow, let's do a vacation video or something like that. But to make it like he's a, you know, a newborn baby discovering yes. ice cream or right. something, and she's there to witness this because she is his hero. Ew, I yeah. don't blame you. Good for
yeah.
you.
Thank you.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah. You know, when I worked in the prison system, I love to say that sentence, that whenever you see like on Dateline and you see them interviewing an inmate or something like that, that was my department that I had to approve or not approve that kind of media access. I turned down every single request for that very reason.
Good.
I thought it exploited people. I thought it was unfair. And I thought all we're doing is making money for 2020 and Dateline and all of those shows. And I thought it was wrong. I thought it was completely wrong.
Yeah, and not only that, but like, if she had told me in the beginning, this is our relationship vlog, I would have been a little bit more, I could have said, no, I'm not going to do that. But the fact that she backloaded it and then said, oh, by the way, we're getting married and we're gonna love each other and all this other stuff. I was like, no, I can't do it.
Now, you're sure she doesn't, she's not in like working in the prison system now and just escape with another inmate. Like the you don't think that's her, do you?
No.
Okay,
that's not
okay.
Cabbage Patch Lady. So, hey, Chris Martin, what do you think of my documentary? Would you have taken it or would you have turned it down?
I think you made the right move.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate it, sir.